Joining us this morning on The Morning Set, Scotty Barnhart, internationally acclaimed jazz trumpeter, composer, arranger, educator, author, and the director of the legendary Count Basie Orchestra. Good to have you on the show, Scotty.
Well, thank you. Finally, I'm glad I could make it. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad we caught up with you, man. You slowed down just enough for us to be able to grab this interview. You know, I want to start, before we go back, I want to start it in the moment right now. You've got a lot of things going on, but the Count Basie Orchestra, they have been on a roll in recent years. Lots of acclaim, lots of adulation, a lot of things going on under your direction. How is the band doing? How are you feeling leading the band? You're still getting that kind of love from everyone. How is all this possible after all of these years with the whole Basie thing? It's just amazing to me.
Well, you know, again, man, two words, Count Basie. I mean, Count Basie, to me and to many people, not just the gentleman in the orchestra, but he was the greatest band leader of all time. I mean, think about it. He passed away in 1984, 39 years ago. And this orchestra is still on the road, still at the top of its game, still identifiable in one or two beats, one or two notes, still selling out concert halls. I mean, big concert halls, as well as clubs and universities or whatever. That's all to him. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He perfected his craft for 50 years while he was leading the orchestra. And the way that he set it up, he really made it easy for the gentlemen to come after him, Thad Jones, you know, Frank Foster, myself. It's easy for us to mess it up. He really, really set it up in such a way, it was just easy to keep going. And the musicians wanted it to keep going. He wanted it to keep going. Audiences around the world still wanted to keep going. And we're just doing what we can, you know. And I think also the key to that is the right personnel. I mean, you've got to have the right personnel that really understand the orchestra, what it's about, how we do things, what Mr. Basie wanted. Everybody has to be on the same page as far as that goes. And believe it or not, there's some people that, you know, were not on that page, which is why they're not there. So it's very specific. It's not an accident. This is not an accident. I tell people all the time, it's not an accident that we are still going because we do things a certain way that everybody's dedicated to doing. And my job is just to make sure we stay that way. That's it. And we just had a concert, three, 4 days ago? When was it? Sunday, near Chicago, and it was a great reception there. The day before that, I can't even remember where we were now, man. I travel so much. But everywhere we go, we can feel the people's love for Mr. Basie and our music, the way that we do things. So I'm just fortunate to be here. I was fortunate enough to just even get asked to join the band, let alone direct it. So I'm still like a kid in a candy store. And I'm the luckiest cat on the planet, I can tell you that much. So my job is to keep it going as best I can, to do things that Mr. Basie would have done, to play things he would have played the way he would have played it. And he just left a blueprint for me, so all I have to do is study. And I'm still studying. It's not like I'm just, you know, okay, let me put a set list together and let's go play. And I'm listening all the time, every day. I mean, my earbuds in or my headphones on when I'm traveling. Even with the band, I'm studying and recording. I got all of them, too. So it's not something that is a huge burden at all. I do feel the responsibility when I do leave my house. I know if something were to happen, whether it's musically or not, Basie's name is probably going to come first. You know, if I go out and get in trouble, it won't be Scotty Barnhart, you know, robbed a bank. It'll be the Count Basie Orchestra director robbed a bank. So I got to, you know, so I'm quite aware of the responsibility that I have. And I just try to do the best I can.
Scotty, I have in my mind this Count Basie desk with a secret compartment. And there's a letter, like the President of the United States, that gets passed from Thad Jones to Frank Foster to Grover Mitchell to Bill Hughes to Dennis McGrow to you.
Yeah.
But you've just told us it's all laid out. There's something about the Basie sound that has those horns so together. Mm-hmm. The swinging blues that he trademarked seems to still work.
Yeah, I mean, it's imagine what it feels like to sit in the orchestra, to play those parts, to help those things happen, but to be standing in front of it, a foot away from it, and listening to it come at you, it's a whole other level. So, man, the music and the arrangers, also, I can't overemphasize how important the arrangers were to Mr. Basie. He didn't let anyone just write for his band. And that still happens today. I'll get something unsolicited from someone, or even sometimes somebody might know me and they'll say, hey man, here's a chart. And I can almost look at the score and tell if it's going to work or not. Basie knew exactly what he wanted. Even composers such as, and arrangers such as Neil Hefti, Quincy Jones, Frank Foster, Basie was still at the arrangements. People sometimes don't know that. Even Neil Hefti, when he brought Little Darling to Basie, which turned out to be one of the greatest big band ballads ever written, it wasn't originally written as a ballad. It was written as an up-tempo tune, and Basie heard it and said, oh, no, 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 no. This needs to be here. And he changed it, made history. So Basie really knew what he wanted. And even on that, since it's on my mind, I just have to tell you a quick story. Doesn't take long, but when I first joined, the bass player in the orchestra at that time was a guy named Cleveland Eaton. Now, Cleveland Eaton also was the bassist with the Ramsey Lewis Trio, with Maurice White, the founder of Earth, Wind & Fire, the three of them back in 1966, 67. He was the bass player with Ramsey Lewis. But by the time he joined Basie, and when I got there, he was still on bass. And so he was playing, and to me, and I still feel this way today, the key to the Basie sound is two things. It's the bass player, then the guitar, then the piano, in that order, I think. Because if the bass player is not playing the right notes, it's not walking a certain way, you can't walk in the Basie orchestra as if you're Ron Carter playing with Miles Davis. That doesn't work. You can't walk like Charles Mingus in here. It doesn't work. There's a very specific way, and I always could tell that it was the bass. Even as a kid, I'm like, okay, this bass player and this band, they're doing, you know. So anyway, fast forward, we're in Thailand, 1993. I'm in my first year in the orchestra, and the bass player, Cleve Leighton, had been knocking me out for a whole year. I've been in the band a year this time. And I'm like, man, this guy, how does he know how to play the certain notes that he's playing? Because the note choice is a very deliberate thing. You don't accidentally play the right bass lines in his orchestra. You have to know what you're doing. So I said, you know what? Let me just ask him. Well, how does he do that? So I said, hey, man, you got to tell me. How do you still know what notes to play behind Basie? When you were in the band with Basie, how did you know what to? So he said, look, I tell you, real simple. And people never asked him this question before, but I'm asking, right? He said, look, when I first joined the band, Basie made me set up my bass in my position on the stage so that I could see his left hand. And whenever I would walk a certain way that he didn't agree with, he would play the bass line for me. So I said, oh, that's it. So Basie knew what he wanted. So it's a difference between doing this. That's a Basie bass line, the way that they approach getting to a certain chord. So Basie shaped his bass lines, and he didn't care who was on bass in the orchestra. He made them set up so they could see his left hand. So that's just that's just one little facet of why we sound like we sound. Again, he knew what he was doing. He knew what he wanted. He knew what he wanted from the saxophones. He knew what he wanted from the trombones, the trumpets, the solo of Stephen. You know, I've heard stories of if you played a solo that really wasn't really, you know, Basie didn't really like, you just wouldn't get the solo again. you just wouldn't get the solo again. So anyway, Basie was a very, very smart a musician, a very brilliant leader who knew how to get the best out of his musicians, shaped around what his philosophy was, and he would draw them into his philosophy, which is really what a great leader does. You just draw people in without them sometimes even really knowing it. And pretty soon, they're doing everything for you, which is still happening. Yeah. If that makes any sense, you know?
It makes total sense. You know, I've always thought that in listening to the Basie rhythm section, that sparseness, that point in the band where the band is allowed to be everything you described, but at the same time relaxed and swinging. And in other words, the rhythm section, the band could get really loud, and then all of a sudden it would just these quiet passages with that subtleness of swing always right there, always there, always driving the band. That was amazing. It helped that Freddie Green was there for 47 years too.
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. You know, when Basie, when they did I think it's on video too, you can get it. It's Basie's 50th anniversary, concert anniversary. I think it's at Carnegie Hall. George Benson's on it. Sarah Vaughan, Tony Bennett, Joe Williams, all these people. But Freddie Green, incidentally, is not there. He took that night off for whatever reason. He just took that night off. And so somebody asked Basie after the show, how was it playing without Freddie Green? He said, oh, I could have my own tempos now. Because Freddie would just lock that stuff in and play in such a way, man. When I first heard the band, when I was like, I think I was 11 or 12 when I first heard them live in Atlanta, it was just an unbelievable wall of sound that I could feel. It's like somebody turned the heater on and I could just feel it, you know? And but Freddie Green and all of the gentlemen in the orchestra, all of the long stays, you know, the Charlie Foulkes on the baritone saxophone, Marshall Royal on alto, they were there together in that section for 20 plus years. Sonny Cohn on trumpet for 30 years. And so the Bill Hughes, who was there for 57 years. So the musicians never left, basically. And they stayed and they helped to maintain and usher in the new musicians who would come in. And all you have to do when you come in is just keep your mouth shut and just listen. Figure out what they're doing, because the way that we actually play, the music that you're looking at doesn't reflect that. I tell people that all the time. You think you can really sight read? Okay, come in and play with us. Because what you're reading, we're not playing that. We've already figured out what to change, what to alter, what to play late, what to play a little early, whatever. We've already figured. And that stuff has been happening for decades. You take a tune like Shiny Stockings, it was written in the mid-50s. We don't play it how they played it in 1956. We don't play that anyway. We don't play it like that anymore. But it's still the same tune. It's just little subtle things here and there. And once you figure that out, you become a breathing you just become a breathing part of the group. You know exactly when you're getting soft, exactly when you're getting loud, exactly, you know. So it's a very interesting orchestra. And I've been on the road with the Ellington Orchestra. I've been on the road with the Lincoln Center Orchestra. And the Basie book is the hardest book. I'll just flat out tell you that. It's the hardest book because there's very little, if any, room for error. None. At all. The closest to be that would be Lincoln Center. They play a lot of stuff, but the Ellington book is really loose. And if you come in a little later, a little early in the Ellington book, no big deal. I mean, you'll still be there. That's just the way Duke wrote his music. And I've been on the road in those bands, and I know the Basie book, that's like the scariest book ever, man, because you can't, as soon as you make a mistake, everybody knows it. As a matter of fact, a buddy of mine, I won't tell his name, but he's in the Ellington Orchestra. He's been there a long time, so he subs with us. You know, whenever I need somebody to sub in the section, and we were just talking about this a month ago. He said, "Man, I don't know. Every time you call me, I don't think I could do it." I said, "Man, well, you know." But anyway, this is what it is.
Let's turn the page a little bit to what's happening today. Of course, yeah. Live at Birdland was an amazing success, and I mean, you gave us so much music in that project, a double CD. Thanks for holding back and giving that all to us at once. Live in Birdland project was a great refresher for a whole lot of people that needed to catch up on the Count Basie sound. Right now, what's on turntables and radio stations around the country is this very modernist approach to Basie called Late Night Basie.
Yeah.
But he's always been a modernist. Atomic Basie, Basie on the Beatles. How does this reflect the hipness of that gentleman who kept his music current for all those years, and even to today with Talib Kweli and Jesmaya Horn and Terrence Blanchard, and Nicholas Payton, and all that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just another example of how Mr. Basie's music is timeless. I mean, it's a vast catalog, but you can pretty much take any tune that the orchestra has played since 1935. And make it and play it today with the musicians of today, and it would still sound fresh. And that's basically what we did. You know, it was kind of a bold experiment, to be honest with you. But I knew it would be fine as long as the music is good, man. As long as the music is of great quality, you know, it's going to be okay. I mean, you could take Beethoven's Fifth, like Walter Murphy did back in 1978 or whatever it was, and it still sounds hip. It was funky. He made it funky, but it was still Beethoven's Fifth. Because of what he did with it. So the same thing with us today. We knew that if we put the music, some of Basie's tunes like Blue and Sentimental in the hands of somebody like Larkin Poe, they would be great with it. I think Basie would have loved it, especially Blue and Sentimental. He would have loved hearing them do that. And so we just try to make sure that we stay as relevant as possible. And, you know, a lot of the times I think people forget that cooperation or collaboration is one of the greatest assets a musician can have. You know, it's not all about competition all the time, trying to get more sales in somebody or win more Grammys in somebody. But what about collaboration, man? What about, you know, taking, you know, supposed opposites and putting them together and see what you can do? And I strongly believe in that. And especially for our next project, the one that's coming out in September, that's just going to knock people's socks off. I mean, all the way off. You know what I mean? And we just try to do what we think Mr. Basie would have done. I mean, even back in the 70s, he toured with Tom Jones. People forget that. Hmm. They were on the same plane together. They played some of, they backed Tom, you know, on his charts and all of that. So I think if we can get more back to the realm of collaborating with other artists outside of jazz, even country artists or whatever the music, the genre may be, and you just kind of meet in the middle and figure out a good way to still stay true to what we do and how we play. As long as we could just play how we play, we'll be fine. And I have some other ideas and things that we'll do in the future too that I hope we can get done. But yeah, this new late night Basie thing, I think it sounds good. And the young musicians are checking it out, which is really good. My students at Florida State, they were shocked when I told them Lettuce and Larkin. They're like, what? Let me go get that. So you got these 19, 20-year-old kids that really are interested in it. And that'll hopefully spur them on to do more research on Basie himself and go get stuff as far back as 1936, 37, you know, with the Decca recordings and all those things up through to today. So they really can see the totality of what the orchestra has done.
Hey, Scotty, we had the pleasure of talking with Carmen Bradford a couple of weeks ago, and all I got in was one question. and Miss Bradford just took off and telling us all the stories, and especially the one about when she first met Mr. Basie and so forth.
Yeah.
I could tell you that she was out here a few months ago at the Greeley Jazz Festival and just excited everybody. And this will be her second visit to Colorado. We were trying to figure out, when's the last time the Basie Band was actually in Colorado? And I don't expect you to have the answer. Nobody around here knows. You know, 1971?
No. We've been in Colorado. It was within the last 12 years.
Really?
I remember being on the bus, and I remember being, we played somewhere, and it's really funny because I was doing the sound check. It was at a university. And when I got through with the sound check, all of the food, the dinner they had prepared for us, nobody left me anything to eat. That's how I remember. And I was so mad because I'm out there doing the sound, trying to get it together, and came back down, and the food was gone.
It's Colorado, for sure, right?
It was Colorado. Was it Greeley? But it was definitely,
could've
I would say,
Greeley.
The last.
Yeah.
Could have been. And then there was, because Dee Askew, our manager, asked me this very thing the other day. And I remember the band. I remember the guys in the band. And one of the guys in particular, one of our saxophone players, he's now in the U.S. Air Force band, and he left us to go do that about 10, 12 years ago. That's how I remember. So within the last 10, 12 years, I've been here 10 years, been leading 10 years.
Wow.
So I think somewhere around.
All right. We got a Basie sighting of 10, 12 years ago. The last one we had was a Central City Opera House, 1971. When Mr. Basie himself was there, I was privileged to be able to hear the Basie Band with Count in the group back in 1978, 79 in the Virgin Islands when he came down there to do a big inauguration, and he gave me 10 or 15 minutes of time backstage.
Wow.
I was just like a young guy in radio doing a jazz show, and I never thought I would ever meet him or anything else. But that's one of my greatest memories that the time to talk to me, and I was just, everybody was just people to him. Didn't matter if you were young or old or whatever, he treated you all alike, and I still have that memory, in my heart for Count Basie.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to have not just one theme song, but have like four? Like you roll in and you guys have to play April in Paris. You have to play 1 o'clock Jump.
Yeah.
You have to play Blues in Haas Flat. You have to play Jumping at the Woods. You have all your songs are theme songs.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you know it's a trip, man. Because the key to that, believe it or not, you can't get the guys bored. So as much as we have to play some of those things, some nights I just don't put it on the set. I just don't. And if somebody asks for it and they come up to me, well, you didn't play this. And I was like, man, you have to understand, these are thinking musicians. You cannot, it's like you're going to somebody every day or having the same dinner every single day. It may be great, but after a while, it's like, okay, I gotta go get pasta tonight. I can't have steak again tonight. So it's a tough thing. And the songs that we do have to play, usually, like you said, are April in Paris. Now, 1 o'clock jump, we play that at the end of every set. That's our theme song. We always play that. That's never a question. But Shiny Stockings, Blues and Hustles Flat, we play every night. Shiny Stockings, we don't play every night. April in Paris, I usually leave that for an encore. So if we don't get asked for an encore, which we always do, so it's always there. And sometimes I put it in the middle of the set. But for me, my main focus is keeping the guys fresh, keeping them on their toes. And I change the set list every single set. It's never the same. From night to night or set to set, it's never the same. So I keep the guys, that keeps them, they can't wait to play because they know what, you know, they don't know what order things are going to be, who's going to get the ballad in the first set, who's going to get it. And, you know, I change it up and I try to make sure everyone gets an equal amount of solo space. So that keeps the orchestra sounding fresh and really, really, really vibrant. But if we played all of those things that everyone, you know, expect us to play every single set, it'll just get boring after a while. It just would, you know.
Not for us.
Yeah. So I just, you know, so anyway, and I tell people sometimes if they have a request of something, if I get their request before we play, I'll add it. Sure, if it's not on the set list, I'll put it there. And I have no problem doing that.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we just, you know, always say before we play April in Paris, and I literally say this, that there are certain songs that we will get run out of town if we don't play. And that's one of them. And I'll explain, you know, why it's our most requested. And, of course, it's associated with the movie Blazing Saddles. I'll go into that. And even like Little Darling, there are certain nights, some nights that we, you know, I'll be thinking about it. And I'll be thinking, okay, but there are other ballads that our alto saxophone player, he hadn't played a ballad in 2 weeks. So do I want to play Little Darling again? Or do I want to give him a nice ballad feature, you know, something fresh and new to the band and makes him feel good, makes him feel appreciated? Or do I still want to stay in this 60-year-old, you see what I'm saying? Mm. So it's kind of a very delicate thing to do. And I think to me, the most important thing is keeping the musicians happy. Because even Basie said that in his very last interview. They asked him, how would you want to be remembered? He said, I want to be remembered as a nice guy. And in somewhere along in that same interview, he said, if my guys are happy, then I know I'm going to get the best out of them. That's an exact quote from him. So he knew, too, that you still, you know, as much as people want to hear stuff, even some one of the guys told me one time when they were with Basie, this is back in the 70s or 80s or something, I think, before he passed away, even if you did a concert in your hometown, you might not get a solo that night. You just might not get a solo because he's thinking about everyone. He's not thinking about just you. You know, you may have gotten a solo the week before, but there's a trombone player. He hadn't taken a solo in 3 weeks. So now here's the time to give this guy, you know, and it might be in your hometown. So for me, I just try to make sure there's a good balance. And I always, when I do the set list, I scan it two or three times to make sure that everybody in that band, there's somewhere they have a solo. Everybody, I go through that. And once I see that and it's balanced, then that's a good set list.
One of the bands, guest bands on Late Night Basie is Danny Jonucucci and the Revisionists.
Yeah.
Is the and if it's not active, I just want to know about the Count Basie contest. Is there a place where bands can come sit in front of you and play their best and you say yeah?
How does that work? Well, you know, they put that contest together for this particular recording, and I haven't heard anything about it being done again.
Okay, all right.
I know it was done for, you know, because they wanted to have somebody like Danny's band be a guest with a track on the recording. So I haven't heard anything about it being done again.
Okay.
So I don't know, you know.
All right,
great. That may have just been the only time for that.
Yeah, great.
Hey, Scotty, before we leave, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you because you've done so many projects and have worked with a lot of people. I appreciate some of the work that you with Marcus Roberts, mm-hmm. and going back. He's also a Florida mm-hmm. native. What's mm-hmm. going on these days with you in terms of other projects musically that we might look forward to? Do you have time for any of that?
Yeah. Well, you know what? The main thing is I'm finishing up the revised and updated version of my book. You know, my book came out in 2005, The World of Jazz Trumpet. It's the only book of its kind on the complete history of jazz trumpets. I don't know if you knew that or not. But that came out in 2005, And Clark Terry and Freddie Hubbard wrote the foreword to it. And I interviewed like 21 people, Sweets Addison, Maynard, Winton, I mean, Clora Bryant, Ted Kersen, you name it. And that book, I knew I needed to do an updated version of it. And so I just finished it. And the new version is going to have 55 interviews, completely unprecedented in this music. 55 interviews. I have everybody now. Severinsen, Arturo, Faddis, Nicholas Payton, Wallace Roney's last interview, Claudio Roditi, Eddie Henderson, Randy Brecker, Tom Harrell, Ingrid Jensen. So I've been working on that now for the last, 10 years or so. And I finally finished it to the point to where now I just have to shore up a few little chapters. And that'll be out hopefully, definitely, maybe if not the end of this year, early next year. And then I'll follow up or I'll match it with my second solo recording. And I've already gotten the band for that together. We've been talking about it for 30 years. And that's Chris McBride on bass, Jeff Watts on drums, probably Marcus on piano, and Ravi Coltrane, I think, on tenor and soprano. So I'm working on that to try to have those two things come together. And but this book has been a main part of my focus when I'm off from Basie and teaching and things like that, because it's very important. I wish we had a book like mine for bass players, where you literally had all of these 50 bass players from the last 100 years that have been interviewed by a bass player who's doing what they're doing. And so, but it's taken me over 20 years to do what I've been trying to do. But the information, and I can tell you, that's in this book, man, I forgot Bobby Shue, Joe Wilder, Gerald Wilson. Now I'm talking to Gerald Wilson about his time with Lunsford. I got all of this stuff on tape, man. I'm a jazz trumpeter, but I'm a fan too. I'm a fan of all of these guys, man. So for them to take the time and talk to me and give me information that you can't get anywhere else, to me, that's been the major thing that I've been working on. And I just think it'll be illuminating. Even when I talked to Severinsen, and I asked him stuff that nobody had ever asked him. I remember Freddie Hubbard telling me the same thing. Say, man, you asked me stuff nobody. I said, that's because I do what you do. I'm not coming at you from a journalist standpoint. I'm a jazz trumpeter, man. I'm trying to, you know, so one of the things that I think is interesting that I love about the book, these interviews anyway, is that the first four or five questions were, I tailored specifically for that person. So if it's Freddie or if it's Gerald Wilson or if it's, you know, Bobby Shue, the first five was specifically to their career, their personal career. The latter part of the questions are basically questions I ask everybody to get the different answers to see how fascinating they are. And one of the guys that I interviewed is Jimmy LaRocca. Now, Jimmy LaRocca, his father was Nick LaRocca, the guy that played in an original Dixieland jazz band, 1917, and when he recorded. I went to his house in New Orleans and spent a whole afternoon with him, and he's 82, 83, something like that. Nobody had ever interviewed him either. And he's telling me stuff about his father that has been in history books that he's telling me has been wrong. So, man, I can't wait for this to come out so people could see what these guys or these musicians are really telling me. But what I meant to say was, for example, just give you one example. One of the questions that I asked everybody that I knew would be fascinating to hear the different answers, it was a word association. I said, look, I'm just going to say something. I'm going to say something. And you say the first thing to come to your mind. Now, imagine telling an 82-year-old man that. Severinsen's 90 when I did it to him. So what happened? So this is what I said. I said, just to give you an example. I said, okay, Mr. LaRocca, I'm going to say something. And you just tell me what comes to your mind. No, I'll start with Severinsen. So I said, okay, Doc, A minor 7. I just said A minor 7, you know, this chord, right? He paused for a minute. He said, F sharp. Now, to a musician, that tells you how his mind thinks. He said F sharp. F sharp is not in an A7 chord. That note is not in that chord. A minor seven. It's not F sharp. It's not in there. That's just give you a little insight into his mind. Now, I asked Jimmy LaRocca the same question. Somebody who's 80, almost the same age as Doc, been playing trumpet for 70 years. I said, okay, A minor 7. He thought for a minute. He said, man, I don't have no effing idea, man. Now that is fascinating to me. That's fascinating because it shows you. So I did that to everybody. And it's, you know, I would just say a name or a word or a chord or whatever. And they would just give, man. And it just shows you the depth of a jazz musician's mind, how wide of a variety of things they can think of, which is why the music is the way it is. And so anyway, that's a long answer to that question, but I'm working on that, trying to finish it up. And trying to decide what tunes to record on this recording, but you know, that's it.
That's well, all.
That's all.
Not much.
That's all. That's all. Not much.
well, I'm working on it, man.
Scotty Barnhart, thank you so much for taking a little bit of time. We're excited because we're less than 2 months away from having you here in town. It's a beautiful.
Yes, yes.
It's a beautiful location. You guys are going to love it. Outdoors in a venue. You know, and everybody who's coming out, they're coming out to hear the Basie Band. At its finest. So, again, thanks for taking time out. I'm looking forward to meeting
you. Can't wait to get there, man.
On a personal, yeah, it's going to be great, man, everything. Come on out and keep swinging the blues a la Basie.